Simon & Schuster Audio presents Star Trek Picard, The Last Best Hope by Una McCormick. Based upon Star Trek, created by Gene Roddenberry, and Star Trek Picard, created by Akiva Goldsman and Michael Chabon, and Kirsten Beyer and Alex Kurtzman. Read by Robert Petkoff. For Kirsten Beyer, with love. Fellow citizens, we cannot escape history. We of this Congress and this administration will be remembered in spite of ourselves. No personal significance or insignificance can spare one or another of us. The fiery trial through which we pass will light us down in honor or dishonor to the latest generation. We say we are for the Union. The world will not forget that we say this. We know how to save the Union. The world knows we do know how to save it. We, even we here, hold the power and bear the responsibility. In giving freedom to the slave, we assure freedom to the free, honorable alike in what we give and what we preserve. We shall nobly save or meanly lose the last best hope of earth. Other means may succeed. This could not fail. The way is plain, peaceful, generous, just, a way which, if followed, the world will forever applaud and God must forever bless. Abraham Lincoln, State of the Union, 1862. It is possible to commit no mistakes and still lose. That is not a weakness. That is life. Jean-Luc Picard. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed, to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door. Emma Lazarus, The New Colossus. Part 1. The Hope, 2381 to 2382. 1. La Barre, France. Many years after. In latter days, sitting alone in his manor, pondering the events of the years that preceded this self-imposed exile, trying to understand where and how it had all gone wrong, Monsieur Jean-Luc Picard, formerly of Starfleet, would often come back to one moment. Sitting on the bridge of the Enterprise, in command, listening to the gentle rhythms and pulses of his ship. Playing back the memory, he would slow down time, as if instructing the visuals to move at half speed, at quarter speed, and he would observe himself sitting in his chair, and he would marvel at the sight of the man he had once been. Calm, assured, fully in command of himself and all around him. This, he would think, was the moment before the storm began. The split second before the end of his old life, when he took the first step down the path to here. The house that had never been the home. The land that he had longed to swap for strange and distant lands, the quiet, the immobility. The knowledge that nothing that he did now with his days mattered in the slightest. One more outcast cast adrift. Prospero on his island. An old conjurer, his magic spent, nursing old grievances. Here, now, this was the moment when everything changed. It was nothing that anyone noticed at the time. His ship, the Enterprise, his home, from which he had been banished, was sailing close to the neutral zone. The old order. a quiet chime on the comm, and LaForge's voice coming through. "Captain, we're picking up some very strange readings here." And he had said, incredible, now that he thought of it, how blind can a man be, he had indeed said, "Anything for us to worry about, Commander?" "Yes," thought Picard years later. "Yes, more than you could have ever known. Watch out. Beware. Choose your course wisely now." "Let me get back to you on that one." Another chime, this one signifying an incoming message from Starfleet Command. Picard stood up, smoothed imagined imperfections from his uniform, and went into his ready room, where he received a summons back to Earth. And all that was to follow had followed. He had not, now that he thought about it, seen the Enterprise since. Clouds flecked across the hillside. The vines hung heavy. The old clock ticked in the hall. Time yawned ahead. Empty time. Picard, in limbo, pondered the past and continued to fail to find answers there. Such were his mornings, his afternoons, his evenings. Such passed the days for Monsieur Jean-Luc Picard, formerly of Starfleet, the most disillusioned man in two quadrants. At this point, usually, Picard would sigh and raise his eyes and look around his beautiful, too quiet land, and he would catch sight of either Laris or Jaban looking back at him, shaking a head, as if to say, "He thinks too much, and it does no good." No, he thought, none of it had ever done any damn good. Starfleet Command, San Francisco, Earth. It was a fine morning for the start of the end of everything. San Francisco gleamed in the sunshine, brash and confident, the sleek and rhythmic pulse at the heart of a great power. The kind of morning in spring that makes the world seem full of possibility. A sea breeze freshened the air when Picard stepped out of the transporter and walked with purpose across the plaza to the headquarters building, waved through at once by a young ensign who purpled at the sight of the great man, ushered with some ceremony up to the Commander-in-Chief's meeting room, Earl Grey tea ready when he took his seat, steam rising in wisps from the cup. A room that spoke of power, of duty, honor, and responsibility. Seated already, two colleagues about to change everything forever.
"What we are about to tell you, Jean-Luc," said the CNC, "is almost unbelievable."
Captain Jean-Luc Picard of the Enterprise, accustomed to believing many impossible things before breakfast, nodded at his commander-in-chief, folded his hands, and made himself more comfortable in his chair.
"I need hardly add that this is highly classified," said the CNC.
Picard, hardly unused to being privy to such information, gave a noncommittal smile. Inwardly, he felt himself tighten, shift onto alert. He gave his CNC a more careful look. Admiral Victor Bordson, several years his junior, was, in Picard's estimation, a careful man. Picard did not mean this pejoratively, quite the contrary. Rather, he considered Bordson to be a man who took care, measured, disinclined to make rash decisions, somewhat impersonal and lacking the common touch. Picard had often tried to place him, not German, not Austrian, not Swiss, not Belgian. What then? He had been amused at a formal dinner one evening, seated next to the man's husband, to discover that Bordson was from Luxembourg. He had only just stopped himself from slamming his palm onto the table and exclaiming, "Of course!" Bordson was not averse to taking action, but considered action. He was decorated, as one would expect of his generation and seniority, multiply so, a veteran of some of the grimmer arenas of the Dominion War. One did not come through repeat engagements with the Jem'Hadar without a mark being left, some bruise, whether visible or not. Typically, in Picard's observation, such officers were dogged, implacable, and more than a little haunted. Northern courage, he believed it was called in the sagas, the determination to carry on even when all hope was gone. Yes, Bårdsen brought to mind the Saxon warrior, shaking his spear at his enemies, sure only of defeat. Thought must be the harder, heart be the keener, mind must be the greater, while our strength lessens. A careful man, a man of cares. Gently, Picard said, "What's going on, Victor?"
"Everything," said Bårdsen, "is about to change."
He turned to his second. Captain Kirsten Clancy, sitting at his right hand, nodded. Leaning forward, she whispered, "The Romulan star is about to go supernova." Picard took a moment to consider some of the implications of this statement. As these became overwhelming, truly and terrifyingly all-encompassing, he lifted his hand to press his fingertips against the right side of his face, an instinctive action that he had never quite suppressed to protect where he felt most vulnerable, where he had been most harmed.
"Mad."
"Quite," said Bårdsen. "Kirsten, shall we look at the presentation?" Clancy reached out and activated a pad. A huge screen on the opposite wall glowed into life. The room began to darken. Before the presentation began, and under cover of the dimming light, Picard stole a rapid look at Clancy. A crisp woman in her middle years, hair short and turning white, she had considerable poise. One also sensed steel, not someone to suffer fools. They had met only once or twice, briefly, in passing, at some function or other. Picard knew her chiefly by reputation, which was, as befitted someone this high up in Starfleet command, exemplary. She also plainly had her eye, ultimately, on Bårdsen's post. Picard did not covet that role, far from it. The commander-in-chief was the person in whom the military functions of Starfleet and the political concerns of the Federation met. A great deal of Bårdsen's time, Picard suspected, was spent setting counselors at ease, appearing in front of committees, listening rather than acting. No, Picard would not willingly take on that role. Give him a ship heading into the unknown, the chance to explore, to make a difference. On the screen, an officer in a gold ship's service uniform was getting ready to deliver a presentation to a small audience. Picard, leaning over to Bårdsen, murmured, "Who has seen this already? Who was there?"
"Me, Clancy, the President, the Chief of Security, the officer giving the briefing, of course, and her immediate superior."
Bårdsen gave a wan smile.
"You're seventh to know, if that's part of what you're asking."
Seventh. A not insignificant part of Picard's mind shifted towards sketching out what the mission was going to be and computing how quickly he could be back on the Enterprise to begin the undertaking. On screen, the woman said,
"My name is Lieutenant Commander Rafi Musiker, and I'm an intelligence specialist at Romulan Affairs. As you're aware, we've been tracking some odd communications from Romulan space in recent weeks. Odd, even by Romulan standards."
Listening to Musiker, Picard found himself taking a liking to her. She had a faintly disreputable air, a pleasant change from the smooth operatives that Starfleet intelligence usually fielded. Her frankness was refreshing, as was the fact that she was clearly not daunted by the grandeur of her audience. Most of all, she was on top of her briefing. A question came about the reliability of their sources, which was dispatched with confidence and ease. Then another question came about the range of the blast from the supernova, and here she stopped and took a moment to collect herself.
"What I want to say is that these calculations are a worst-case scenario. This implies that effects in climate change are already being felt. Sometime in 2387. I'll show you that first, because it might make the best-case scenario less damn frightening."
Picard leaned over to Clancy.
"What was her name again?"
"Rafi Musiker," said Clancy,
Lieutenant Commander Rafi Musiker. Picard filed the information away for future reference. On the screen behind Musiker, a simulated model of the Romulan system appeared. Its wounded star lay in the center. As Picard watched, the star imploded and concentric circles spread out from its death throes. They fanned out and out and out, on and on. Someone in Musiker's audience said, "Holy fucking shit." Picard could not be sure, but he thought it might be the president.
"Yeah," said Rafi. "You know, I've watched that maybe 24 times now, and let me tell you, it never gets any better. It only ever gets worse." "Life, huh? Only ever gets worse. Let me show you the best-case scenario."
This, Picard thought, as he watched the rings spread out again, was stretching the definition of the word best beyond reason.
"Our best estimate?" said Rafi to the question Picard was posing in his mind. "The impact is likely to be felt within 9.7 light-years of the Romulan star. Whichever way we model this, and trust me, we've run a lot of models, the threat to the stability of the Romulan Star Empire is catastrophic. Shall I go into the specific ramifications of this, or are the broad lines pretty clear?"
"Quite clear," Picard thought. Trillions would be affected, not only in the home system, but well beyond. He leaned forward in his chair and watched the presentation to the unhappy end. Beside him, his tea, forgotten, cooled. "Nothing will ever be the same again."
Monsieur Jean-Luc Picard, recalling himself thinking this, almost laughed out loud at the naivety.
The presentation ended. Rafi Musiker was held freeze-framed on screen for a split second, and then her image was replaced by the symbol of Starfleet Command. Clancy raised the lights.
"Well," said Bordson.
"We must help," Picard said simply.
"Indeed," said Bordson.
There was a pause as the thought of what that might involve seeped through the room.
"Whatever happens, Victor," said Picard, "saying that is worthwhile, and will also be worth remembering whenever we face doubts or obstacles, as we surely shall. But we must help."
"Yes," Bordson said. "But how?"
Clancy stirred. "There are significant complications, not least that the Romulans are not entirely keen on Federation involvement."
"No," thought Picard, "they would not be. Have they asked for help yet?"
"They've only just admitted to us that the star is going supernova," Clancy said, "and then only because we sent them some of Musiker's reports, and their own secure communications back at them." She gave a grim smile. "They didn't like that much."
"I imagine not," said Picard.
"The good news," said Clancy, "is that after—" She pushed out a breath. "Well, let's say that after a few intense days of negotiation, the Romulans have agreed to some limited involvement on our part. But we need to play our hand carefully if we want to ensure that agreement holds." She shook her head impatiently.
"We're trying to help, and they're playing hard to get."
"Secrecy is hardwired into the Romulan psyche," Picard said. "What have they said?"
"They won't allow us into the home system," Bordson said. "No surprise, but we are being allowed limited access to some of the systems beyond. The environmental impact won't be felt as badly there, but the stress on infrastructure most certainly will. If we are successful there, and keep the Romulans on board, then we might be allowed to help further."
"How many people?" said Picard.
"Across the worlds to which we have access?" said Bordson.
900 million.
A massive undertaking in itself. Picard rose from his seat and walked over to the window. The view from Bordson's briefing room was marvelous, of course. The complex of buildings around HQ, the vast ocean, the blue sky. One could become overly familiar with such a view, he thought. One could begin to take it for granted. How safe Earth was, how beautiful. impregnable, like a castle that had never fallen. How would one feel to learn that one's home was going to be destroyed? To know that you would have to leave all that was familiar and safe and loved and never return. It would be like being forced to leave the stars behind, reduce one's vision to a limited horizon, or worse, to nothing. It would be terrible. Behind him, Clancy was talking about the need for diplomacy, for building consensus not only with the Romulans, but here at home, for ensuring that the will was found to act. "It will mean ships," Picard said. "A great number of ships, and the people to crew them. Thousands of ships in time, given the numbers of refugees. The capacity to take many people to many different places, and then, when they arrive at their destination, the capacity to aid them. Food and shelter. Homes, schools, doctors. Work. Fulfilling work. Good facilities. Places where we would be happy to live. Not haphazard and temporary camps." He shuddered at the thought, as anyone in their right mind should. No, he would not allow that. He would not see people treated as no better than garbage, to be disposed of, thrown away, piled high. These should be places that encourage hope, not despair, that bring relief, not disappointment. Turning, he saw that Clancy was alarmed. "Now let's not start overreaching," she said. "We don't have much information about what the Romulans are doing themselves. We only know that they've agreed that we can help. They've not yet said exactly how much help they'll eventually allow, and we don't know how much relocation work they're carrying out themselves. This might be a matter of a small fleet of refitted ships removing a relatively small number of people to safe locations."
"No," said Picard firmly. "In the face of such a calamity, there can be no half measures. We have to be ready to scale this mission up."
Clancy appealed to Bordson.
"A relief effort like that would be unheard of."
"A disaster such as this is unheard of," said Picard.
"But thousands of ships?"
"If necessary."
"That would significantly change what Starfleet does," Clancy said. "That's going to affect what we can do going forward. We would be changing our core mission for, what, the best part of a decade?"
"If that's what's needed," said Picard, "then that is what must be done."
"Well, I'm not sure the political will is there." Picard was sure that it was not. Clancy pointed out, "Without the support of the Federation Council, we won't get the resources, and without the resources, we have nothing more than castles in the air."
"I agree that this is unprecedented. So is the disaster," said Picard. "It will demand the very best of us, the best engineers, the best administrators, the best ships."
"But for how long?" said Clancy. "Are we willing to sacrifice to get it done on that scale? All the planned exploration? What if they're canceled now? Are there enough ships that can be diverted to this? What else gets cut? Reclamation work on frontier worlds? Terraforming projects? How do you think that will go over with the citizens of the Federation? How do we choose? What goes? What stays? And even if we can get everyone behind this, how do you persuade people that helping the Romulans is in their interests? How do you persuade the Romulans?"
900 million people, Captain, Picard said softly. Maybe many, many more.
Bordson raised his hand.
Thank you both.
He rested his head upon his hands and closed his eyes. After a moment, he said,
Political will, yes, never easily achieved, not even from our own people. And the Romulans, I'm doubtful, very doubtful. But you see, keep thinking of those rings spreading outward.
Picard nodded.
Yes, yes, Bordson understood.
He had grasped what Musiker had shown them.
All the truly great emergencies we have faced, Bordson said, the climate crisis, global wars, interstellar wars, it is too easy to forget what the cost was to the individuals who suffered through these events.
I keep remembering what those rings mean. On the ground, you understand. For the people there. What those rings signify. Loss of home, of all that matters, all that is familiar. I keep thinking of this.
He opened his eyes, and he glanced at Picard.
It is clear that we must help, and in a serious and committed manner.
His gaze fell on Clancy.
How will we achieve that? That is what we shall learn over the coming weeks.
The problem is that this won't be a matter of weeks, sir, Clancy said. Starfleet will be in this for years, as long as we understand what we're getting ourselves into.
I believe we do.
Bordson sat back in his chair.
Who should lead such a mission?
He turned to Picard.
Jean-Luc, a moment or two while I consider who might be suited.
No need, said Bordson. The job is yours, if you want it.
Clancy gave a short laugh.
Fools rush in.
Picard did not reply. He turned back to the window. He stood and watched the ocean ripple. Bordson's words about the people who must live through this disaster had moved him profoundly. Still, some part of him shrank back from the horror, the enormity of what this calamity meant. Hundreds of millions of people to be removed from their homes, some unwillingly, surely, and transplanted. Where? Where would they live? What would they do after this? What would the Romulan Empire do? Would their culture survive? Could it? These were the fears of one part of him. But the other part, the best part of Jean-Luc Picard, was already mobilizing for the work that lay ahead and had been even before Bordson's offer. Standing there, looking across the Pacific, it suddenly felt to Picard as if history was aligning correctly, such as when, in a game of chess, check is declared, and the soon-to-be winner sees precisely how well their moves have been laid. For one bright and joyous moment, Picard knew he was the right man at the right time, a man presented with a serious task for which his life, his experience, and his temperament made him uniquely suited. He could do this. He would do this. In the future, Monsieur Picard gave a hollow laugh that echoed back down to the past. He turned back to Bordson and Clancy. His voice was far steadier than he imagined it would be.
Very well.
Bordson and Clancy exchanged a look.
Very good, Bordson said. Congratulations, Admiral Picard. I beg your pardon.
You said it yourself, said Bordson. An unprecedented project. We can at least acknowledge that formally.
Besides, he said, it's long overdue.
Picard, oddly moved, merely tilted his head. Bordson wasn't finished.
You understand this means saying goodbye to the Enterprise.
Ah, said Picard. He walked back over to the table and sat down heavily. He picked up his cup. The tea was stone cold.
And there I was, thinking that there would be no catch.
Oh, there's always a catch, said Bordson.
Kirsten, will you explain? We know you'd rather go in with your own ship and your own crew, Clancy said, but the reality is that Enterprise is a red flag to the Romulans, the flagship, the symbol of our enmity. Enterprise has been their foe far too often. We don't want to remind them. We need to be extremely diplomatic right now, do you see?
Can you do this, Jean-Luc? Asked Bordson. Without the Enterprise?
Picard hesitated. Yes, they were right. To the Romulans, the Enterprise was hardly a signal of amity. But do this without his people? His crew? Those that he knew so well, trusted so completely? To try to do this vast and unparalleled task while learning the ways of a new crew, a new ship?
You don't have to decide immediately, Bordson said with compassion. Take a day or two. Consult your senior staff. Kirsten's already arranged the security clearances.
No need, said Picard. I'll do it.
The belief was profound. He was the right person. The one with the vision. The one with the ability. He must not let this pass. No, not that, which sounded like vanity. It would be wrong to let this pass. There was no task in the universe more important than this. Starfleet must help. He must help.
Good, said Bordson. Then let us deal with the simplest question first. Who takes command of the Enterprise?
Worf,
said Picard, as Clancy said, not Worf.
First check, I see, said Bordson dryly. Let us practice what we preach and build consensus.
Kirsten, what is your objection? Is this about what happened on Sukkara?
A bad decision made almost a decade ago in the kind of situation where 9 out of 10 officers would have done the same thing. Worf had been on an undercover mission inside Dominion-controlled space with Jadzia Dax, his wife. Dax had been badly wounded, but Worf had chosen to go back and save her life rather than continue with the mission. The Dominion agent they had been sent to extract had died as a result.
He made a bad call on Sukkara, Clancy said. An agent died. Who knows how long we could have staved off the Dominion war with his information? Worf knew that when he made the call. He was choosing to save her.
This was almost 10 years ago, said Picard. Surely his faultless record since must count for something.
But it goes to his judgment, said Clancy. Would he make a call like that again?
Hardly likely, thought Picard, jaw tightening, given that Jadzia was dead.
On the other hand, given what happened last time, Worf may be even more considered about his decisions. I must protest the idea that a question mark hangs over my XO's judgment. Do you honestly think, Captain Clancy, that I would select a first officer who I did not think was both worthy and capable of commanding a ship of their own?
A slight flush rose on Clancy's cheeks. You know him better than I do. You've worked alongside him for many years.
Yes, indeed.
But this is the flagship we're talking about. She turned to Bordson. He received a formal reprimand. Sir, for the good of the service, I have to bring this up.
Picard glanced at Bordson. He was giving nothing away.
Let me make another point, said Picard. A century ago, one of the moons of Kronos exploded. The Klingons were unwilling to take our help at first, but they did, and in time, our interactions led to the Khitmor Accords. Our relations are now so cordial that we are considering whether a Klingon might be suitable to assume command of our flagship.
Imagine the impact of this.
Imagine what we would be saying. We would remind people not only of the help we gave then, but of how far our friendship with the Klingons has come since then. And in so doing, we suggest how far our friendship with the Romulans might evolve.
Bordson said, He has a point, Kirsten.
She was looking less certain.
The optics are good.
He's a fine officer, Picard said with quiet resolve. He will make a fine captain.
Bordson looked at his second.
Well, any other objections?
She glanced at Picard. I thought someone should raise the issue, that's all.
Picard acknowledged what he assumed was an apology.
Then we are agreed, said Bordson.
Worf takes command of the Enterprise.
Good.
2 promotions in 1 morning. I feel quite dizzy with power.
He studied Picard.
I imagine you'll want to speak to your crew immediately. Let them know what's happening. We've set an office aside for your use.
He rose from his seat. Mission command, for the moment, until your new ship is found.
Picard, standing, looked at him curiously.
An office in place already. You didn't doubt that I'd say yes?
Bordson smiled.
No, Jean-Luc, I didn't doubt that for a second.
They shook hands. Clancy, too, reached over to shake hands with him.
We are all behind you, she said. We're going to do our damn best to make this work. Please remember that.
And he did remember. Or tried to. Outside Bordson's office, Picard took a moment to collect himself, standing still with his hands clasped together, his eyes closed. In another man, such a stance might be mistaken for prayer, but Picard was thinking yet again about those concentric rings fanning outward and the worlds upon which this disaster was going to fall. An hour, he thought, and his whole universe had changed utterly. A lesser man might panic, but Picard was decisive and hardly careless. He should, he thought, get to work. He opened his eyes and wondered where he might find his office. His eyes fell on a young Trill officer hovering at a polite distance. When she saw him move, she stepped forward to speak to him.
"Admiral Picard, sir."
News traveled fast, thought Picard. "I am he."
"I'm Lieutenant Vianu Call, sir. Admiral Bordson has assigned me as your aide-de-camp while you're here on Earth. May I take you to your office, sir?"
Picard, open-palmed, gestured along the corridor.
"By all means, Lieutenant."
They walked along together. Picard waited for the inevitable.
"May I say what a privilege it is to meet you, Admiral, sir?"
Picard gave the gentle, generic smile he had perfected for these moments. Young officers, astonished to be in the company of a legend, were often left breathless and stammering. One reason he favored his crew. There would be a great deal made over his mission in the coming days, he thought, regretfully. He would have to be on his best behavior. The senior staff on the Enterprise were used to his moods and did not mind when he was irritable. He would not be able to permit himself such indulgences for a while. He did not wish to disappoint young and earnest officers such as this, but he would need an outlet. Who would be a good foil for him? Who could he bring with him on his ship once the mission was underway? Data would have been his first choice, of course, but... Call led him briskly into the elevator, down a level, and then out again into a large and airy space that was currently almost empty. One or two people were there, busy at their desks. They jumped up as Picard sailed past.
"Your staff as it currently stands, sir," Call said, almost apologetically. "Procurement specialists, mostly. Those people are magicians."
"We'll soon fill the space," Picard said calmly.
There was room for a dozen more. That would do for a start. But the operation would expand, and rapidly. He would need experts in this kind of work. He nodded across the room to a private office.
"Is that for me?"
"Yes, sir. Sorry your name isn't on the door yet, sir."
That would have been a significant piece of sorcery. I didn't know I was taking on the mission until half an hour ago.
Call, momentarily wrong-footed, took on a panicked air. Then she saw the twitch of Picard's lips and relaxed ever so slightly. Picard, too, eased. The sooner they could get past this stage, the better.
"Of course, sir."
Call opened the office door.
"Well, this is your space. Fairly basic, but enough to get things underway, I hope."
A desk, a chair, a computer. Sufficient for now. Picard went to stand behind the desk.
"Can I get you some tea, sir? Earl Grey tea? Hot? Is that correct?"
Picard smiled, this time completely freely.
"Exactly correct, Lieutenant. Thank you. That would be most welcome."
The tea arrived quickly and not replicated. He drank a little and then ran his hands over his desk. There could be no more delays. There must be a new ship, a new crew, a new fleet, a new mission, and a new way of life. But first things first. He composed himself and opened a channel to the Enterprise.
"Worf," he said, "my dear friend."
When the door closed behind the new-minted admiral, Clancy fell back in her chair and gave a sigh of relief.
"I'll be honest, Victor. I wasn't sure we'd pry him from his ship."
Bordson smiled wanly.
"Neither was I,"
Clancy gave him a sharp look. Didn't doubt for a second, huh? The occasional judicious white lie never harmed a soul. Clancy stood and stretched. Well, at least we keep the flagship dealing with something other than all this. She held her hands out as if to try to grasp the enormity of the operation. Something will still be out there reminding us of our mission. And what better than the Enterprise, the heart and soul of Starfleet? Bordson eyed his second shrewdly.
Tell me what worries you, Kirsten.
Again, she gestured outward. This mission, it's massive, unprecedented, the scale of it. It could consume Starfleet for a generation.
But it has to be done. The alternative is unimaginable.
So you and Picard say. But can it be done, Victor? Can we sustain the will for this? We've only just managed to get the Romulans to agree to let us help. Sometimes I think they'd rather their people died than reveal anything to us.
She shook her head.
And if the Romulans don't want us, how can we persuade our leaders that we should be involved? How can we justify it?
That, I must admit, is my chief concern, said Bordson. That we overreach.
One misstep, and the Romulans will be arguing that this is invasion by stealth. Like the Cardassians on Bajor, offering aid as a prelude to conquest.
We helped Bajor, said Bordson.
And then Bajor joined the Federation. The Romulans must be looking at that and thinking, is this how their aid works? Is it all conditional? Will we escape intact?
The Romulans, said Bordson, must take care of their own paranoia. In the meantime, let us do all that we can while we can, and hope that we carry the day for long enough to make a real difference.
The afternoon turned softly into evening. The sun lowered majestically over the darkening water, setting the sky aflame. The rich, warm light of a non-hostile star. As the day lengthened, Picard continued to inform his senior staff one by one, his trusted advisors, his friends, that he was not returning to the Enterprise. It took longer than he would have liked to reach Beverly. She was in surgery, it transpired, not an emergency, but a long overdue operation on a junior officer who, he recalled, had found excuse after excuse to delay the procedure. Such intimate knowledge of the crew of his ship. He would no longer have this. He would not know the people around him as well as he knew this crew. As well as he knew Beverly Crusher. At last, she appeared on screen. She was tired.
Hi, Jean-Luc. Is this urgent?
The wind was taken out of his sails.
Not urgent, no.
It's been a long day, that's all.
Beverly, I'm leaving the ship.
She leaned back in her seat.
You do yourself an injustice, Jean-Luc. That's the very definition of urgent. What's going on?
Quickly, he sketched the situation, the dire need, the mission. She listened calmly, she was always calm, as he explained why the Enterprise could not go to Romulan space and why he was leaving. When she heard his full news, a puckish smile crossed her lips.
Admiral, hey? I always knew you'd make it eventually. I used to say to Jack, that one will go far.
Beverly, I'm going to miss you terribly.
Oh, Jean-Luc.
No, listen to me, please. Before I lose confidence. You have been my friend for almost my entire career. I have not had a better one. The gifts of your friendship have been infinite.
Jean-Luc, you're talking as if you're never coming back.
I'm going a very long way.
I know.
She looked at him almost expectantly. Would she come with him if he asked? She would be a great asset, of course, a vastly experienced doctor on a relief mission like this. Did he dare ask? She sat watching, waiting, and then she sighed. The moment had passed. He had never quite summoned up his courage when it came to Beverly Crusher.
"Can I offer you some free advice?" she said.
"Of course, Beverly, of course."
"Put someone right next to you who isn't scared of you."
"Scared?"
"You're quite, now let me get this right, not intimidating, not severe. Huh. That's it. You can be quite certain of yourself. And that can stop people from telling you things that you need to know."
"Certain of myself?"
That half-smile again.
"Don't get me wrong. With good reason. Most of the time. But you're only human like the rest of us. You make mistakes. And you need someone there who's able to tell you when that's happening."
Her face fell.
"Particularly with a mission like this. So much at stake."
"I'll find somebody."
"Good. I won't worry so much in that case."
"Thank you for worrying nonetheless."
She gave him a full, sweet smile.
"Oh, Jean-Luc, I'll never stop."
He nodded. Could not quite trust his voice.
"Are you coming back to say goodbye?"
"I'm afraid not."
"I see. All right, then. Well, I'll make sure everything is packed up safely. Do you have a forwarding address yet?"
That question caught him. Where, right now, was home?
"Here to Earth, I suppose, until I know my new ship."
"Consider it done."
She shook her head.
"Captain Worf. Did any of us see that all those long years ago?"
All those long years.
"I certainly didn't."
"I guess we couldn't keep you forever."
"I hope I've made the right choice, Beverly."
"It's what you were born for. Congratulations, Admiral. It's long overdue."
"Thank you, Beverly. For everything."
And he let her go.
Before what would be his final call for the day, another cup of tea appeared, which Picard gratefully received. Call hovered over his shoulder, carrying a pad.
"Go home," said Picard gently. He pointed to the pad.
"Leave that. I'll read through it before I go."
Call hesitated, but was clearly loath to disobey an order.
"Are you sure there's nothing else I can do, sir?"
"You can get a good night's sleep. Be back here in the morning, ready to work like you've never worked before."
The Trill's eyes shone.
"Of course, sir."
She put down the pad and made to leave. At the door, she hesitated again.
"This really is an honor, sir."
"This mission," said Picard, reaching for his cup of tea, "will be enough honor for all of us."
Call left, the door closing behind her. Picard opened a channel once again to the Enterprise. The familiar face of his chief engineer appeared on screen.
"Geordi," he said warmly.
"Sir, what time is it there?"
Picard shrugged.
2000?
"I thought it would be getting late. I figured I might not hear from you until the morning. But big news, hey? Admiral?"
Picard's lips twitched.
"You've heard."
"Well, you know Worf. Can't keep his mouth shut."
Picard laughed for the first time in what seemed an age.
"That certainly sounds like Worf."
LaForge smiled.
"You know, it was clear something was up. He did me the courtesy of looping me in rather than leaving me hanging."
"He gave you the reason why?"
"He did."
LaForge whistled.
"I've got to say, sir, you've got your work cut out for you."
"Speaking confidentially, Geordi, I fear I may have underestimated the sheer scale of the task ahead."
"I bet you have, because I've been thinking about it all day, and I'm raising my estimate of the size of fleet you'll need by the minute."
900 million people, by the most conservative estimate. How does one go about moving that many people? Do we even have the capacity? How do we move them? Where do we move them to? What do we need in place for them when they arrive?"
"Well, I'm going to leave the touchy-feely people-handling stuff to the kind of folks who excel at that kind of thing, but I've got plenty of ideas about hardware. We can talk them through when I arrive. Picard looked at him with sudden hope.
You're coming here?
You're going to ask me to come, aren't you? He'd thought of asking, yes, but then thought better for LaForge's sake.
Well, the Enterprise. I couldn't ask.
The greatest engineering project our generation will ever undertake, and you weren't going to ask me to come on board? How long have we served together now? Geez, I could be offended if I thought about this for too long.
Relief rushed through Picard. Of course it must be Geordi LaForge. Who else? And even more, to have one old comrade on this new voyage, wherever this mission should take him, that was a great blessing.
Thank you, Geordi, he said. I mean that from the heart.
Admiral, I've been packing since this morning. Got my passage to Mars all fixed.
Mars, the home of Utopia Planitia Shipyards, Starfleet's main vessel design and construction site. The number of ships this mission would eventually require was going to have significant impact on the facility.
I'll be frank, said LaForge. You're going to have to give me some fairly serious executive authority there, because we are looking at a major retooling if we're going to get enough ships off the production lines quickly enough. I bet you dollars to donuts there'll be complaints.
He pushed out a breath.
This is going to be serious work, and it's not so much the raw material as the labor. Who's going to build these ships? Can we find enough people? Are there enough people?
I had barely begun to think about that, Picard said.
In the end, you see, it always comes down to labor. Anyway, I'm working on it. I'll speak to the engineers at Utopia Planitia, see what they suggest. And I'm sure to have ideas of my own once I'm there and have a look around. Well, the good news is there's going to have to be some major innovations in shipbuilding technology over the next couple of years. Going to have to be.
Problems Picard was only beginning even to conceptualize, and LaForge was already working on them. He was glad he had not deferred this call. He already felt better, more optimistic about the prospects of success.
Congratulations on the promotion, by the way, said LaForge.
Thanks, said Picard, and gave a short laugh.
He had more or less forgotten about that. How odd. After all this time, and it barely figured.
All right, I'm going to get back to my packing. I'll see you when I'm done on Mars.
Geordi, Picard said abruptly, are you quite sure? This mission, it might require everything. The rest of your career.
Somebody has to help these people, sir. I think I can help. That's sure enough for me. Is it sure enough for you?
Yes, said Picard. More than enough. Thank you, he added with great feeling. You give me courage.
No problem, Captain. Admiral. Whatever. All right, you get back to what you need to do. I'll get on my way.
LaForge closed the channel. Picard sat back in his chair. So now his last link with the Enterprise had been severed, for better or worse. He was, for the moment, a captain with no ship, a handful of staff, and a major operation to mobilize. What, he thought, as he picked up the pad that Call had left him, would that involve? He anticipated leading from the front, as ever, on board a ship, directing operations from inside Romulan space. That meant he would need someone to run this office on Earth while he was away. A starbase on the Romulan border needed to be a forward command, and there would have to be someone to run the show there. Most of all, and perhaps most pressingly, he lacked a second. Someone to take on the task of ensuring his orders were carried out. He was grateful beyond measure to have LaForge working with him, but he had a vital job, one that would keep him near Mars. Picard needed someone at his side, someone to travel with him as these rescue and relief missions got underway. Someone who understood in full the difficult and charged situation into which they were flying. Someone who could handle not only all kinds of Romulans and Starfleet admirals and Federation politicians, but someone who could handle Jean-Luc Picard. An XO he could trust to tell him the truth. Not somebody cowed by the name, the rank, the legend that surrounded Jean-Luc Picard.
Did such a person exist?
Data, of course, would have been the perfect fit, but...
No, thought Picard firmly. One could not dwell on what could not be. Clearing his throat, he turned his attention to Call's report. The first 7 ships had been reassigned to his fleet.
7.
That was a start, he supposed. Nearly 1 billion people. 7 ships would barely scratch the surface. A man could be daunted by a task like that, but Jean-Luc Picard was a man of great wisdom and experience, and not least among his talents was the ability to know when to worry and when to delegate. There was very little that he could do, alone at 2000 in an office that had been operating for no more than a day, about his lack of ships, and he already had someone working on that. For the next 10 hours, this could be LaForge's problem and his alone. Picard was tired now and hungry. He put down the pad, rose from his chair, and walked across the room to look at the bullpen space beyond. The lights were dim. His staff of 3 had all left for the day. Tomorrow, according to Call, there would be 10 people there, and the next day there would be 15, and so it would continue, the mission expanding as the huge starship that was Starfleet slowed down and switched course, turning its considerable skills and capacity toward this vast and vital work. The work of a lifetime. Picard left his office and turned to face the door. There, fixed in place, was his name, gleaming in what remained of the light. Admiral Jean-Luc Picard. He tapped his fingertip against it lightly.
Procurement, he murmured as he went in search of dinner. Truly, they are magicians.
2.
Admiral's log. 1 week, and thus far no Romulan lives have been saved, yet I'm pleased with the progress we have made. Whatever orders Victor Bordson has given, every request has been met. Personnel, officers, equipment, and the promise of 15 Wallenberg-class transport ships within 4 to 6 weeks. I have the makings of a solid team here at command, with more expertise being brought over from various agencies such as the Colonization Bureau. I shall soon be able to leave Earth and begin to take the first fleet of ships into Romulan space. It is a great relief to know that I can leave advocacy for this mission in Bordson's careful hands and get on with the work that needs to be done. I must also acknowledge the efforts of Captain Kirsten Clancy, who has been chiefly responsible for liaising with the Romulan military. She has had considerable success in negotiating Starfleet access to the planets most in need. We have, remarkably, been permitted to travel into Romulan space unaccompanied, provided we follow precise and pre-agreed routes. I assume this means that their resources are already stretched thin. I am prepared to discover an occasional cloaked ship monitoring our progress once we go beyond the neutral zone. Our first mission has been narrowed down to 3 worlds, Tavaris 4, Ectis 2, and Incitor 5. These 3 worlds are, of course, beyond the Romulan home system, but are likely to be among the first affected by the internal changes happening within the Empire. My instincts tell me that the Romulans will ask us to proceed first to Ectis. A small mining colony, Ectis is completely reliant for essential supplies such as food on imports from the home system. As well as transporting the colonists, we have offered to assist in settling them at their destination, when that is decided. But the Romulan authorities have assured Starfleet that everything in that respect is under control. The residents of Ectis 2 are, in the main, relatively well off. The mining operations there are, as I understand it, largely automated, and the engineers and technicians who maintain the systems enjoy a comparatively high standard of living. I suspect that this will bring its own problems. However comfortable we make the quarters on our ships, we cannot replace the homes that they must leave behind. I have tasked a small team to consider what can be done to make our ships more agreeable to our guests in terms of design and layout.
I can by no means justify expending a large amount of resources on this, but it seems that some small consideration of this issue will go a long way to helping our guests adjust to their change in circumstances. In the meantime, I too must adjust to my own change in circumstances. I receive regular missives from Diana instructing me not to underestimate the impact upon my own well-being of leaving behind the ship and crew that have been my home, and, I must say it, my family, for so long. The enormity of this task, and the rapidity with which the number of staff assigned to the mission grows, does not leave me a great deal of time to reflect on what I have left behind, but I confess that I do find the absence of someone in whom I can confide somewhat trying. Our first mission will be ready to commence in 6 weeks, by which time I hope to have my own ship, and I must make a decision about an XO very soon. I do at least have some potential candidates in mind.
Starfleet Command, San Francisco, Earth. Lieutenant Commander Rafi Musiker, when asked to wait for a senior officer, did not generally sit patiently in a chair, and she saw no reason to do so for a legend either. She stood outside the Admiral's office, bouncing up and down ever so slightly on her heels, ready for action. All around her, the office was bustling. Only 6 days since the Admiral had been appointed, and there were 2 dozen people here, busy with the preliminary tasks involved in getting the mission up and running. A huge interactive map of the Romulan Star Empire was displayed at the far end. Likely relocation sites were marked in green, other secondary possibilities in amber. There were 6 people standing in front of the map, talking rapidly, highlighting worlds and getting full data up on the screen as they needed it. Information and colors updated as they conferred and made decisions. At the workstation near where she was standing, a painfully young ensign was studying a running update from the USS Nightingale, which was being refitted as a people carrier. Wallenberg class. Good choice. That's what Rafi would have picked, too. They were often used to ferry colonists, so they were capacious and able to cope with a large number of civilians. At the next workstation, someone was talking via comm about temporary shelters.
Well, can we replicate them?
No, I'm not sure yet what the weather conditions will be like on the ground.
Well, what are the resettlement parameters?
Hey, don't worry, it'll all be good.
We got these things to work on Cardassia Prime, and that was a freaking hellhole.
Rafi smiled. Everyone here was keen, and they were going to have to be. Many were in Starfleet uniforms, but not everyone. There were some civilians, wearing the logo of the United Federation of Planets High Commission on Refugees. This was going to be an interesting mission, Rafi thought, combining the political clout of the UFPHCR with the personnel and materiel of Starfleet. She guessed it could go one of 2 ways. The 2 organizations working in harmony, pulled together by the enormity of the task, or else there would be a tug of war, each side trying to press their priorities and working practices. And that was only within the Federation. The Admiral was going to have to juggle Romulan requirements. Someone hurried by, apologizing as they brushed past, carrying a stack of pads. Paperwork. If there was one thing you could rely on, whether civilian or military, it was the rapid expansion of paperwork. Rafi mentally ran through her presentation one more time. The instruction to see the Admiral had been brief, courteous, and not particularly informative as to the purpose of the meeting. She knew, from superiors and colleagues, the impact of her presentation, and so she assumed she was here to give a direct one to the man himself and answer any questions he might have. Then, back to her desk at Romulan Affairs. Only now, she would have met a legend. Gabe, her son, was dying to hear about him. Mom's job was mostly that thing that meant she didn't always make his soccer matches, but every so often she managed to deliver something incredibly cool like this. The door to the Admiral's office opened. Rafi snapped back to the present.
A young Trill officer came out.
He's ready for you now, Commander.
Rafi walked inside. The Admiral was sitting behind his desk, eyes intent on the screen there. Thank you, Cole, he said, slightly absently, attention elsewhere, but still polite. The door closed, leaving the two of them alone. Rafi stood patiently, used to senior officers who were always completing some task before turning to the next one. She took the opportunity to appraise the great man. Calm, focused, looked like he kept very fit. She surveyed the room. Remarkably tidy for the office of the person heading what might well be the biggest mission ever attempted by Starfleet. The only hint of disorder was the vase of flowers at one end of the desk, a stunning bunch of riotously bright chrysanthemums, yellows, pinks, oranges, and a deep shade of vivid crimson. Some of the petals had fallen and lay like lost souls on the desktop. She wondered who had sent them, or whether this was the kind of thing that came as standard in your office when you reached these dizzying heights. The Admiral closed the screen, rose from his chair, and came to greet her. The legend come to life. She had the edge on him when it came to height, but he moved with a commanding grace.
Commander, he said, thank you for making the time to see me today.
His voice was measured, cadenced, the kind of voice she suspected that you could not help but listen to and then do exactly what was requested.
Happy to supply whatever you need, sir.
She looked around the room for an audience that wasn't there. Didn't he have a senior staff in place yet?
Are we meeting here?
He gestured to two comfortable seats in the corner of the room where teapot and cups stood waiting on a low table.
Take a seat.
Tea?
Sure, thanks.
Rafi sat, uneasy in the easy chair, putting pads on the floor beside her, and then leaning forward, palms on her knees. He took the chair opposite, smiled disarmingly, and poured tea.
I assumed I was giving a presentation this morning, sir.
She sipped her tea. What the hell was this stuff? It tasted of goddamned perfume. Was it too late to ask for coffee?
I've watched your presentation half a dozen times now, he said. It's insightful, informative, and precise. I was very impressed.
Hey, Gabe, wait till you hear what the great man said about Mom. Thank you, sir.
Could you tell me, please, from your perspective as an expert on Romulan affairs, what you believe our chief difficulty will be in Starfleet's dealings with them?
He didn't waste time, did he? Rafi took a breath.
Opposition, sir, she said. Believe it or not, they are not happy that Starfleet is devoting so much time, energy, and resources to helping them. They are hating all this. They hate that we know they're in trouble, and they hate accepting help. They won't want to lose face.
I understand. What else?
And even if they're united on this, they'll be divided among themselves about what to do with us. Some will want to accept our help for a while. Some will try to make it impossible for us to function. Others might try to get rid of us.
By force?
By subterfuge, more likely. Secretly, so that half of them won't know whether it's a sanctioned operation or not. The saying in our office goes that Romulans don't tell their left hand what their right hand is doing.
The Admiral nodded. Yes, he recognized that.
That makes them inconsistent and unpredictable, Rafi said. Not to mention damn annoying. They'll say one thing and do another, and they won't even know themselves what their real policy is toward us. Expect the unexpected, sir.
I see. Would it help at all, Commander, if I approached Ambassador Spock and had him petition the Senate to instruct cooperation with this mission?
Excuse me, sir? How would that help?
He looked surprised.
The ambassador surely commands considerable respect.
Rafi laughed out loud.
Spock? They think he's a nutcase.
His eyes opened wide.
Shit, she thought. Me and my big mouth.
She had a vision of herself explaining to Gabe
No, the Admiral hated me, and that's why I'm being court-martialed.
Hold on. Was he smiling?
Sorry, sir, she said quickly. No.